Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is Rick Rosoff. Rick, are we connected?
Yes, we are, Steve, and I can hear you at least.
Oh, good. I can hear you just fine. We want to talk about two topics today, and they may seem unrelated, but they are absolutely very much related. I'm talking about things going on in Ukraine and things going on in Syria. And the name of the game, the common theme on both of these topics is Washington's planned regime change. So we've got a war going on that is anything but civil. Calling it Syria's conflict, a civil war, is an absolute misnomer. There's nothing whatever civil about it. It's a foreign invasion, U.S. planned, death squads used, the president of Syria, Assad, a blame for the crimes they commit, the situation in Ukraine. Well, Rick, I'll let you comment on this in just a moment. The situation on Ukraine, same thing. In 2004, there was an orange revolution. The sitting government today, the Yanukovych government, was ousted by that revolution. And what do we have going on in Ukraine today? Orange revolution 2.0. The tactics are different, but the strategy is exactly the same. Get rid of a democratic government, an independent one, and substitute a stooge government, a pro-Western one, that'll basically take orders from Washington and other key EU member states. Britain, France, whatever. That's the name of the game. And there's dirty stuff going on in Ukraine with Western-sponsored violence. Washington's pulling the strings mainly, but you get Britain doing it, you get France, maybe Germany, maybe some other EU countries. And I'll let you comment on the latest scandal, Rick, with U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, making a faux pas. She will never live down for the rest of her life. Why don't you comment on that?
Yeah, you're alluding to the fact that current Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, who, incidentally, to demonstrate once again, if your listeners need any further proof of the fact that under a previous administration, that of George W. Bush, she was U.S. permanent representative, which is to say ambassador to NATO.
Yes.
She's also the spouse of Robert Kagan, of course. Yes. So she's part of the inner circle of, think tank is truly a misnomer. There's very little thought involved in, the crude actions, as is demonstrated by her comment. But that is, of course, that she was overheard, taped, and then the taped recording of her comments were posted on YouTube, I believe. Stating vis-a-vis the European Union. I'll spare your listeners the expletive, but it's F, the European Union. And
we'll just call it the F word, Rick.
Yeah, the F word, indeed. So this is diplomatise as conducted by the U.S. State Department, which is no surprise. And unfortunately, Steve, I may have to take issue with you. She'll let it down. Just as, her former boss, Hillary Clinton, made all sorts of outrageous, just ridiculous, calumnious statements vis-a-vis Russia in the first place. But, you have to recall that her former employer, and I'm sure friend, personal friend, Chicago's own Hillary Clinton, who ordered, this is unprecedented in human history, ordered four heads of state to step down from power in 1 year, in 2011, in Ivory Coast, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. And got her wish in three out of the four cases, unfortunately.
Rick, I agree with you. She absolutely will live it down, but it won't
should
be
not live it down.
Soon what she said. I don't know that Hillary ever used the F word. I have an article that I'm working on for tomorrow. I simply title it Washington's Dirty Game, but it stars Victoria Nuland. Who else?
But she's the heroine of the day, with Susan Rice not in the news tremendously. They're keeping her under wraps, of course, after the Benghazi fiasco. Hillary Clinton is feverishly arranging matters so she'll be the next commander-in-chief of the world's sole military superpower, a likely prospect, incidentally, to make your listeners shudder yet more.
Oh, unfortunately, true, because it's a long time between now and 2016. But she certainly is the front runner right now. Hillary.
Yes, regrettably. That's my perception as well. There's the infamous comment, by the French social thinker Joseph de Maistre some 200 years ago that every people gets the government it deserves. And I had always shied away from endorsing that feeling it was a slander upon the people in most, you know, every country in the world. But I wonder if we permit the likes of Clinton and both Rices, for that matter, both Condoleezza and Susan, and the other weird sisters that have come to dominate U.S. foreign policy recently, Victoria Nuland being the most recent addition, to continue to hold high public office and not be chased from their post, then in fact we deserve whatever government we get.
Oh, it's very true, Rick. In the article that I'm writing for tomorrow, I've got a good bit of it done, and it'll go out tomorrow. It'll be on my blog site, Steve Lenman blog. I include a profile of Victoria Nuland, and she goes back. I mean, she goes back to the Soviet days, but she worked for Dick Cheney. She worked in the Clinton administration. She really has it really is a deplorable rap sheet. That's about the only way you can explain it. She worked in China for a time.
I look forward to seeing your article. But here again, you know, this is somebody like Talleyrand in France, who is foreign minister of top-ranking minister with seven or eight successive governments in France. It didn't much matter, right? I mean, you know, the government of Louis XVI, or the government of, you know, the convention and the directory and Bonaparte and the restoration. And somebody like Nuland, for people who waste their time disputing the minor differences between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to foreign policy, at any rate, you know, ought to look at that brief thumbnail sketch you've just given me, where she comes in and out of administrations, Democratic, Republican, it really doesn't matter. And, you know, her loyalty is to the transatlantic elite that insist on dominating global politics rather than to our own country, for that matter, and certainly not to any given political party, evidently.
Oh, indeed, Rick. In my article, for listeners who haven't seen the video, maybe who don't know about the video, I'll include a link to the video. It's a 4-minute audio. It's on YouTube, and I've only listened to a little bit of it. I didn't listen to it all, but I think it's complete with nothing bleeped out. So you'll hear her comments. She was talking with Washington's Ukraine ambassador, a man named Piat. Am I pronouncing his name right? Pyatt.
I have no idea, but I'll trust your account of it.
Oh, it's a name that was brand new to me, so I really don't know anything about him. But they were exchanging a conversation. They basically were plotting the overthrow of the Ukrainian government. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, the limited account I've read of it, I haven't heard, actually, the audio tape, but the limited account I've seen of it, read of it, rather, is that she was basically reproaching her NATO allies in the European Union,
yes,
which is all they are, for not being quite as fervent as she and her government are in calling for just that, regime change in Kiev. So that, as virulent as the European Union and NATO have been in demanding, one-sidedly criticizing the incumbent government in Ukraine, evidently that's not at a fast enough pace or ruthlessly enough for Washington, so they can use the kind of foul language you've just heard, which, again, is an indication of how far. I mean, not that the U.S. perhaps arguably has ever had a true diplomatic core. You know, witness the outgoing U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, who has no diplomatic background whatsoever. He's never been in the State Department, no diplomatic training. He's nothing other than a color revolution specialist. As I presume, incidentally, when you look into this matter a little further, the current U.S. ambassador in Kiev will turn out to be also.
Oh, indeed. So comment about the individuals that Washington is promoting in Ukraine. Klitschko, the former world heavyweight boxing champion. I know nothing about boxing, so I don't know. I don't know what division or whatever, but he's a very big guy. In the pictures that I saw of him.
Yeah, he's heavyweight boxing champion.
Heavyweight boxing champ, a tall guy as well. And this fellow who Victoria refers to as Yats. Yatsenyuk. My pronunciation is not as good as yours, Rick. One other fellow, a fellow named Tiani Baka. I'm probably botching his name. He is the most extreme one. This Swoboda Party leader. He's a fascist.
That's correct.
And Nuland, I saw a photo Thursday night, Nuland together with these three guys in a room, it's almost like sitting around deciding how they're going to chop up Ukraine, and you'll get this piece, and you'll get this piece, you'll do this, you'll run that, and the hell with the sitting government, we'll get rid of them, and then you guys are coming in. But this guy Yats is Victoria's choice to be the lead guy.
You're correct about that, and a couple of things. Vitaly Klitschko, has been described by me, if you must know, is kind of a composite Sylvester Stallone character. He's Rocky meets Rambo, in that he's, you know, not particularly cerebral, I don't suppose. You know, very little finesse and subtlety about the fellow. He muscles his way into situations, but he is, you know, simultaneously a sort of stereotypical Cold War Reagan-era Rambo character who is going to fight the Russians at every turn by proxy or directly. In this case, you know, probably a combination of the two. The two other parties, party leaders you mentioned, who are the Svoboda chief. You know, the word is the general Slavic word for freedom, but it is, as you mentioned, a fascistic, a neo-Nazi organization. Until recent years, I think as recently as 6 years ago, their official logo was, you know, an indisputable variant of the Nazi swastika. And these are people, these are, you know, these leaders are amongst those making comments that not only xenophobic and, you know, racist by nature, anti-Semitic. It's, you know, they're a pretty foul group, but apparently this meets, you know, State Department standards, White House standards for, you know, democracy transformation leadership. This is also a triumvirate, and I think that's an important point to note. The Orange Revolution of 2004-2005, similarly, was crafted after the Georgian model, which had their triumvirate also, you know, Saakashvili being the leader, but there were two others, one of whom he, you know, subsequently disposed of, Shivanya, you know, whose family accuses Saakashvili of murdering him. So this is, you know, the nature of the color revolution. But in Ukraine, 10 years ago, it was, you know, Viktor Yushchenko, Yulia Tymoshenko, and Alexander Moroz. And now we have the similar pattern. They're indisputable. They happen every time. They happen in Kyrgyzstan in this manner, as well as in Ukraine and Georgia. So the script doesn't vary, you know, tremendously from the State Department or the Central Intelligence Agency. And the other two leaders you mentioned are the head of the Svoboda and the Fatherland Party. I mean, these names conjure up even, you know, Nazi Germany, don't they? And this is a sort of... the people you're dealing with now. As Nuland was meeting with these three, you know, within hours, so was Catherine Ashton of the European Union, their foreign affairs point person, and the Polish Prime Minister was holding a video conference with the three. So, you know, clearly there's a coordinated effort by the, for all the difference there is, U.S., EU, NATO bloc, of, you know, Nordic would-be supermen bent on global domination. And what they're... clearly, planning is phase two of a push, of a takeover, of the disposing of a legitimate elected government and the planting of a proxy government subservient to the West. That is, you know, unquestionably what's going on in Ukraine.
Indeed so, Rick. And I'll just wrap up this segment by saying there are 46 million Ukrainians, roughly. Literally, the future literally hangs in the balance on how things play out. And if Washington gets its way, complicit with the key EU countries, then I really feel sorry for the Ukrainian people. If they think, if they're at all unhappy with what they have now, it'll seem like paradise compared to what's coming. They should really know, because they got a taste of it after 2004. They should know better by now, but here we go again. Let's switch topics for the rest of the program, Rick, and talk about the situation in Syria. You know, and I know, and I think a lot of my listeners know, that there are so-called peace talks going on. Well, they're really not peace talks. They're regime change talks, because the topics that really need to be discussed, number one, stopping the terrorism, stopping the conflict. Syrians, civilians, are being murdered every single day. The number one priority is to stop this stuff and then start debating and discussing and negotiating on where things go from there. And also, that international law must be respected, and it's very clear. I've quoted it so often that my readers, Rick, think I'm a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, but anybody can read. The stuff is in plain English. No nation may interfere in the internal affairs of another nation for any reason whatever, except self-defense if you're attacked. Well, of course, America pays no attention to international laws. It does what it wants to. But Syrians alone have the sole right to decide their future. That's not even on the agenda to be discussed. The opposition doesn't want to discuss it. And as you know, Rick, the key elements in the opposition aren't even involved in the talks. The so-called terrorists, the extremists, the Al-Qaeda types, The al-Nusra types, they want nothing to do with peace talks. They want to keep fighting. And the people who are in the peace talks, the so-called Syrian National Council delegates, they're U.S. stooges. They have no power. There's no moderate forces against Assad to speak of. It's really these extremist jihadists are the ones that you have to come to terms with. And how can you do it? I'll let you pick up on that, Rick, but my first thought would be cut them off from all funding, training, and weapons. Cut them off completely, and sooner or later they'll fade away. It may take a while, but sooner or later they'll fade away.
You frame the discussion, with all the essentials. I thank you for that. Again, the parallel between Syria and Ukraine is simply incontestable. It's impossible to miss. Though I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that a key Russian parliamentarian, Alexei Pushkov, who is in the State Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament, he's actually the chairman of the International Affairs Committee in what would be the equivalent of our House of Representatives, mentioned about December 21st, as I recollect, that what's happening in Ukraine right now is U.S. and Western revenge for Russia preventing Western plans to go to war against Syria late last August after Obama's speech on the subject. And I believe that we have to recall that even though Syria may not be gaining all the notoriety or the public focus as Ukraine is currently, that it certainly, as you're indicating, not on the back burner. It's still actively a regime change, a very bloody one, far worse than Ukraine at this moment, attempt to overthrow a government viewed to be, certainly no threat to any other country, not even to neighbors, but not sufficiently compliant with U.S. wishes and as such marked for extermination, much as the four heads of state I mentioned Hillary Clinton ordered to step down in 3 years ago, and Assad being the only one still in power, right? So that we have that going on at the same time, and we have the geopolitics of the situation, too. There's no question but that you're correct in how you characterize the so-called fighting forces on the ground. They're a motley group of mercenaries, fanatics, mercenaries and fanatics, accountable to heaven knows whom, ultimately presumably receiving Saudi money and maybe Turkish, Jordanian, even Israeli direction from special forces and intelligence agencies, with the West and their Gulf Cooperation Council, Persian Gulf monarchy allies, ultimately supplying the arms and the training and so forth. And also, the false legitimacy, as you mentioned. The Syrian National Council is supposedly pressured by John Kerry, U.S. Secretary of State, to attend the Geneva II talks at the beginning of this month to make it look as though, the U.S. has to apply pressure to its flunkies, which is ludicrous. But
ludicrous indeed, Rick.
Yeah, coming out of that within days, almost immediately after the Geneva II talks, the same John Kerry, Secretary of State of the United States, lambast the Syrian government as being, his own word, barbaric. So this is how seriously we're to take negotiations with the U.S. and its NATO allies on one side. And Russia, once again, being the only major power that has attempted to intervene to prevent a catastrophe in Syria comparable to what's occurred in Iraq and Libya. And we can see the consequences of those, too, as the bloody internecine fighting continues in Iraq at an unparalleled level, and pretty much the same situation obtains in Libya. If anybody truly wants to replicate those models in Syria, they are misanthropic and criminal to a degree almost unspeakable.
Well, indeed, Rick, and nobody really knows how many people have been killed in Syria. Conflict began around March of 2011, so we're pushing very close to 3 years. The UN comes out with estimates every now and then. There's a so-called group in London that comes out with its own estimates. I don't think anybody does a body count, so nobody really knows. But, it's many, many people. I saw one report that January, while the peace talks were ongoing, they began January 22nd, so fairly late in the month. There was a day or two with 40 countries involved, each making speeches, most of them very anti-Syrian. And the Syrian foreign minister, Walid al-Amolan, gave a very passionate, lengthy address, and Secretary General Ban Ki-moon criticized him for speaking so long. Well, it was him against all the other countries except for China and Russia, and maybe one or two others that might have been measured in their comments. conference. But basically, most of the other countries, their representatives, just took their time, maybe 5 or 10 minutes or whatever, to beat up on Syria unjustifiably. So Al-Molin deserved a chance to respond, which he did. And then we had several days of talks between the SNC delegates and the Syrian delegates. The Syrian delegates, respectable people, I mean, people who really knew what they were doing. But again, the right topics weren't brought up. So the talks over a few days accomplished zero. Syria agreed to come back and participate in a second round. I saw different dates. I saw one date, I forget who mentioned it, might have been a Russian diplomat, I'm not sure, said it would either begin on February 6th or up to the 8th, and another date I saw was February 10th. Well, Syria will go back despite the futility and participate again. And correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, but I saw one report this morning that said the SNC delegates will not come back. Is that true?
I don't know. I mean, I hadn't even seen the report, so again, I'm in your debt on this one. One thing I would caution, because it's been my suspicion since last summer that what is ultimately going to occur is going to be a replay of the Yugoslav scenario in early 1999, the Rambouillet talks in France.
Yes.
And what has to precede that then, again, is an alleged mass atrocity occurring immediately before the talks. The talks are then hastened. The U.S. walks in, brings even more fanatical and, how would I put it, intolerable representatives to face off against the Syrian government. Ones they know in advance that the Syrian government could not, if it wanted to retain any legitimacy, even be seen at the same table with. We're talking about terrorist elements, of course, extremist elements. And then basically compel the Syrian government to walk away or to not sign a preconceived agreement that the West is pushing, at which point the Syrian government is portrayed as being recalcitrant, and the bombing begins. This is no doubt an arrow in the quiver of the U.S. and its NATO allies and its Gulf allies. And it's something I think, rather than focusing too much attention on the actual mechanics or even on the dates of a Geneva III, if you will, meeting, I think what's important is what are the machinations behind the scenes, what sort of intrigue the U.S. and its allies plotted. They may decide to focus their attention on Ukraine for the next 2 weeks and diminish the comparative importance of Syria in their plans. However, they're going to use both simultaneously. That's also a way of throwing Russia off balance. To create a firestorm right on the Russian border, the 1,400-kilometer border, I believe, between Ukraine and Russia, at the same time as they would heat things up against in Syria, would put Russia at a disadvantage in responding to the Syrian crisis.
And at the same time, Rick, that the Sochi Olympics is taking place.
Yeah, you can throw in that as the third factor. These people keep reminding me, and it's worth something you wrote about at the time, by the way, and I want to, in retrospect, applaud you. But we have to recall that at the beginning of the Summer Olympics in 2008, the very morning of them, the very day of them, the U.S. puppet regime of Mikhail Saakashvili launched an attack on South Ossetia, thereby triggering a five-day war with Russia. And this is while, the Russian head of state was in Beijing for the opening ceremonies. So there is reason to believe that with the Sochi Winter Olympics occurring, this is precisely when the Victoria Nulands of the world and the John Kerrys and the John McCains are going to plot their most reckless and dangerous and criminal activity.
Rick, well, I remember August 2008, and I wrote about it, and I was amazed because I got invited on Russian television, not RT.com, formerly Russia Today, not Voice of Russia. I have no idea what channel it was, but I was invited on Russian TV for 30 minutes all by myself to discuss what was going on in Georgia, the invasion, South Ossetia, the invasion of Saakashvili into that country and the bloodshed that happened, and many, many Russian citizens in that in the South Ossetia. Russia intervened to protect its own citizens. I think we could sum up the strategy of what's going on now, Rick, in Ukraine and Syria, is Washington essentially, Washington's pulling the strings, Washington's running everything, making both governments an offer neither one of them can accept, and then blaming them because they won't accept it. The same thing that happened in Yugoslavia.
Right, you are. That's it. An ultimatum where the consequences are complete capitulation and ultimately dissolution of the country as a nation state on one hand versus overpowering air war to bomb them into submission on the other hand. That's the Hobson's choice they're being given.
Rick, let me throw a question at you. I didn't mention it at the outset of the program, but I'm also writing an article. I'll put it out tomorrow on the Sochi Olympics. It's not about the competition. It's about the shenanigans that may be going on, including possible terrorist attacks and so on, and the U.S. media just beating up on Putin, which they love to do. But is it possible that Washington really might want to shake up the Olympics with a false flag terrorist attack? Can you see that as a possibility?
That was my first thought when I woke up this morning and heard the news about the opening ceremonies. I said there could be something horrendous plotted or planned. And we do have to remember the reports of, Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia a few months ago, meeting of Vladimir Putin. And according to the interpretations of that meeting I've seen, that he basically wanted to make a deal with Russia, Prince Bandar, that you give us Syria and we'll call off our terrorist in southern Russia. You know, if anything like that is true, that is outrageous to a degree almost unimaginable. But it is, in one sense, an acknowledgement that Saudi Arabia is funding Wahhabi extremists, not only in Syria, but in southern Russia, not only in the Caucasus, but in the Sochi area, and that at will, the Saudis could, with U.S. and NATO compliance, unleash such types in some sort of terrorist bombing or whatever you're alluding to, which I think is a distinct possibility. I'm sure everyone there in Sochi has that in the back of their mind right now.
Oh, I'm sure Russia absolutely is very cognizant of that. And I would point out, Rick, which I think you'd agree with, that the so-called terrorists, you can call them Al-Qaeda, you can call them anything you want. I mean, these people go back to the 1980s. They were U.S. assets, U.S. allies against Soviet Russia. They were used in the Libya war. They're being used in Syria. Is it out of the question to think they won't show up in Sochi?
Not at all. As a matter of fact,
I
really hate to say it, but I'd be almost surprised if they do not.
We've got a lot of days to run, Rick. I certainly hope Russia is smart enough to outsmart them. I'm not going to follow the results of the games, but I'm certainly going to pay very close attention to this kind of stuff that's going on. And if there's something important that breaks, I absolutely will write about it. Rick, many, many thanks for coming on. It's great to have you always. You've got tremendous insight. It's really an honor to have you on the program to share them with listeners.
Let me return the compliment. It's always an honor to be on the program.
Thank you, Rick.